how to read a what was it?
Business statement. Was it?
You know, financial statement. Like how to read a
balance sheet.
Like
it was a balance sheet. Sorry.
Thanks.
Is that the cold open right there?
I think we have it.
Welcome to the Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So last week, Marlene and I participated and kind of sponsored the HBR Legal Information and Knowledge Services, or LINCS, conference. And it was great seeing so many of you there. And I particularly wanted to give a shout out to one of our podcast mega supporters, Marshall Vizard, from Hughes Hubbard in New York. Marshall jumped into the Three Geeks breakout room that we had there at the virtual conference. And he told us that he has listened to absolutely all of our episode, and that's just crazy amazing.
That is very impressive. And so, you know, I do want to say that we're happy it's not just us who listen to our catalog.
I'm forced to as the editor. I have to listen to them. So thanks, Marshall, for listening and supporting the show, and especially for letting us know.
We really do appreciate all of you who take the time to listen, and we very much enjoy hearing from you.
So we'd love to give more shout-outs to listeners, so reach out to us and let us know what you like, what you don't like, or what you would like to hear on an upcoming episode. So our contact information is in the show notes. So, and thanks again, Marshall. You are very cool.
Hashtag Marshall is cool.
Yep, even Pod Dog agrees.
Yes, Pod Dog does agree.
Well, Marlene, we have this great interview with two law professors at Richmond Law School in Virginia. And I want to thank Roger Skalbach there at Richmond for arranging this meeting for us. We had such a good conversation that I think we just need to go ahead and jump right into the discussion.
Yes, thank you very much, Roger. We'd like to welcome Josh Kubicki, Director of Legal Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Richmond School of Law, and Jessica Erickson, law professor and director, Richmond Law and Business Forum. Josh and Jessica, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
So there's a lot of discussion about how law schools can better prepare law students for the practice of law, including the business of law. And I, for one, also get asked a lot of specifics by what it is they could be exposing the students to while they have them that would make them, you know, more practice ready. So I think we have a couple of law professors here who not just asked the questions, but have actually put some practical skills teaching into practice there at Richmond. So Jessica, before we get into any specifics of what you and Josh are doing there with your different programs at Richmond, can you tell us what you saw as was either missing or needed some kind of adjustment in the legal education to better prepare your law students for the, you know, the real world of practice?
Sure. So I'll actually go back about 5 years and say that at that point, many of us on the law faculty, and I'd really give credit to our dean, Wendy Perdue, who said, we know that law students, our law students, need a broader set of skills. We have a general sense as to what they are. But candidly, I mean, most of us are traditional law professors. We teach doctrinal courses. We're in clinics. We teach legal writing. We couldn't exactly pinpoint at that time exactly what the set of skills were. And we recognized our own limitations there. So what happened was about 5 years ago, the dean put together two committees. And one committee was what I would say is more on the business side of law. And one committee was on, I'm going to use a term that I hate, but on the softer skills. The question was, within each of those buckets, what should we be teaching? And how then should we incorporate those skills into our curriculum? And those committees each spent a year separately and often talking to each other along the way, but really doing a deep dive. And we looked at a lot of surveys of law firm partners. We looked at the client side of things. We looked at what other law schools were doing. It was really a pretty comprehensive review, trying to build out what are the precise set of skills that we thought that our law students needed. And none of this was to say they don't need what we were already teaching them. We think they need legal writing, they need legal doctrine, they need the skill side that we were doing across the board. But we had the sense that there was something more. And at the end of that year, both committees came up with, you know, pretty lengthy reports that went into a lot more detail about what we thought our students needed. And on the business of law side, we thought they needed more around business and finance, more around understanding the industry, more about understanding project management, process improvement, how legal services are delivered, how they should be delivered. And so we were able to come up with a pretty robust set of skills that we thought our students needed. And we did the same on what we started to call our professional identity formation side, that students needed to be able to determine the values of the profession, understand what their own values were in connection with the profession, understand and cultivate skills like empathy and active listening and leadership skills. We then came up with this long list of skills and realized that, frankly, they weren't being taught as systematically as we would like through our curriculum. And that doesn't mean they weren't being taught at all. They were. I mean, certainly if you look at our clinics, they teach a lot around active listening and those skills, just as one example there. But, the clinics were doing a lot of the heavy lifting on this. And we decided to build it out more systematically. And so we hired two new people. We hired Josh to run our Legal Innovation and Entrepreneurship program, which is now Legal Business Design. And then we hired Janice Kraft to run our Professional Identity Formation program. And so the students start with what is now a required one credit class in their first year on professional identity formation, thinking through the values of the profession and their own values, and developing some of those other skills. And then we have this panoply of electives in the 2L and 3L years, both on the professional identity side and then also on the legal business design. So that's where we ended up. I will say it was a little bit interesting to go through that process as a faculty and realize at the end of the day that what we had thought law students needed was pretty darn close to the Delta model.
Yeah, I was going to say, as you were listing it out, that's exactly what I was thinking.
That reassured us a lot, but I will tell you our process was separate and from theirs, and we got to the end and saw, other people got to the same conclusion. So that was reassuring. So that's probably more than you wanted, but that was our process.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like you're going right into my next question. We've interviewed several guests who, are promoting innovation in law school, and you mentioned the Delta model. So we've had Kat Moon and Allison Carroll on discussing that. We've had Jennifer Leonard discussing Penn Law's Future of the Profession Initiative. Nicole Morris highlighted her Tiger program at Emory. And Ann Tucker and Ben Chapman talked to us about Georgia State's Law and Business Analytics program. So Josh and Jessica, where do you think your program fits into this world of law school innovation programs?
I'll tell you broadly how we saw it as we were building it, but then I'll really turn it over to Josh, who's much more, in the thick of this. For us, when we were crafting it, we talked to many of the people that you just mentioned. So Kat Moon, Allison Carroll, Nicole Morris, they were all really helpful to us as we tried to figure out what we wanted to build. I think what makes our program unique is that we were not just on the business side of law, nor were we just on the professional identity formation side of law. We thought it was very, very important to launch both programs at the same time. We thought, I want our students to have the business side. I'm a corporate lawyer myself, so that's my doctrinal area of specialty. I very much believe in it. But I think the professional identity formation side is just as important. And vice versa, we didn't want to start that side without getting to think about the industry more broadly. So we launched these together, and our hope is to really build out a robust set of courses that starts with a required course in this area and then builds out for lots of electives for students to explore their particular passions.
So I will add there, where we fit in sort of the ecosystem or spectrum that you guys have sort of outlined for us, I think we fit a very unique yet complementary place. I don't think we're trying to do something different for different sake. I think we see an opportunity in the market where others haven't or others haven't taken action yet. And that is really sort of on equipping our law students with the business, not just knowledge, but actual skills to go design businesses. And by the way, a business can be nonprofit, a business can be public interest. It can also be their own practice in big law. One of the things we start in the Legal Business Design Hub is with the recognition that legal services, no matter what type of organization, they're delivered through a business model. So it's incumbent on future lawyers to understand at the granular level, what a business model consists of. And one of the things that we teach always, and we touch on this in almost every class that I teach, is if you're going to design a business, you've got to do three things really well. Design it really well for your customers or clients so they're getting value. Design it for the business so that you're generating value. You don't want to be losing. You don't want to be losing money year after year because that's not a sustainable business. And you want to be designing it for yourself and your employees and everyone who's delivering that, right? What is that worker experience? And just to take it back to professional identity formation, it's interesting because Professor Kraft and I hired at the same time. The dean and Jessica and other sort of key faculty have given us lots of room to sort of discover our law students, meet them where they are, and sort of design the curriculum around them. And Professor Kraft and I continue to sort of meet on these sort of central themes, and that is make sure that the lawyers are leading or can lead healthy personal lives, professional lives, and business lives. And so, Jessica, yeah, you said sort of the soft skills, but that's where sort of this really meets the road. We don't want to be putting law students out there who are solely focused on just being amazing lawyers, which is great, but we also know that in a profession, when you put your personal health aside or you put your employees' well-being aside, we get into some of the troubles and some of the themes that we're discussing now for the first time in a long time in the industry as a whole. So our programs are really sort of designed to mitigate that and hopefully eliminate it in future lawyers.
And Josh, you mentioned this in passing, but I wanted to kind of clarify. I know a lot of programs, it's pretty easy, I think, to set them up as though most of your students are going to go into big law. But I imagine Richmond's kind of like my old school, Oklahoma, where, yeah, there's probably, 10, 15, 20% of the people that will do that, but you got 80% that's going to go somewhere else. And your programs are focused across all of the, the future places that your students land?
Absolutely. In fact, just this semester, I'm in the midst of teaching a building blocks for small and solo practices. So these are those lawyers who, what I would say, are already, they're going to be entrepreneurs who happen to be entrepreneurs as lawyers building legal businesses, right? So it's all around the pragmatic and practical skill set that you need to go build a successful small practice.
Great. Yeah, that's good because I think a number of the programs that we've read about, I think, tend to be very focused on the big law setting. So it's nice to see a more well-rounded program. Jessica, I wanted to get back to you because there was something that caught my eye as I was researching what you're doing there at Richmond. And I noticed that, Richmond there participates or is one of the initial schools participating in what's called the Institute for Future Legal Practice. Why did you guys pick that to participate in that? And from what I'm reading, it's a boot camp model. And can you tell us what are some of the benefits of having that boot camp model?
Yeah, so IFLIP, as I think it's often called, has changed a lot over the years. And so when we first started to participate in it, we were one of the initial schools. I would say we fought a little bit to be part of those initial schools because we saw it and were really intrigued by it. So what it was originally, and Bill Henderson and others created this, was that students would go and do a three-week boot camp, either in, I think, Chicago, Boulder, or Toronto, on these business side of law skills, what they called the T-shaped lawyer, and those skills across the top of the T that lawyers need a little bit of exposure to, but not to be experts in around, business, process improvement, etc. They would do that three-week boot camp, and then they would do a 10-week paid internship with a company or a law firm or a nonprofit that was interested in having interns who were trained in these topics. And so we had students at Bryan Cave, we had a student at Cisco, we had students at really some great places. The first year, I believe we had 5 students. I think we had the second highest number of students in that program. And it was fabulous for them. I mean, I can't emphasize it enough. I actually have a student who then went back and did the 7-month advanced program the following year with Cisco. She just started working for them full time. I mean, it worked for her. And then we had students who said this was the best professional experience I ever had. I mean, it was truly fabulous. I was so interested in it. I was just, frankly, the coordinator of it on the Richmond side. I didn't do any of the the building of it. But I actually went out to the boot camp for 3 days and sat in Chicago in the classroom with the students because I wanted to see what they were learning and how they were learning it. And I found it fascinating. My understanding is that over time, iFlip's business model became tough to sustain. It was tough to put all of this into place. As a law school, we weren't paying for any of it. And so it has shifted. And Josh can talk more about what it looks like today.
Hey, I wanted, before you start, I just wanted to ask, how did they match students with organizations?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what happened was that essentially the schools were able to nominate people. This is how it originally started. The schools were able to nominate, I think we got to nominate 5 people. That number could be wrong. And once they went through our screening process, they were put into a pool of essentially screened applicants. And then iFlip did some screening on their end, but then the employers would do their own interviewing and hiring from that pool. So the employers got to pick who they wanted, but we found that our students did pretty well in that process. The second or third year, iFlip opened it up not just to that first set of law schools, but to lots and lots of law schools. And I think then it was a little bit tougher,
sure.
You know,
for every competition,
at least. Yeah, I mean, from a school perspective, I could put in my time on it if it meant we had 5 students going through this experience. If we're going to have 1 student putting their experience, it's probably not a great use of my time. So it became a little bit of a harder sell as it went on. But Josh could talk about what it looks like today.
Yeah, I mean, for those interested, it's been an interesting journey for iFlip. And the reason why I would speak on their behalf, I'm not formally associated with them. I mean, I guess maybe I am. So when they they launched the Modern Law Practice certification classes and curriculum, which is 5 modules, about 2 hours each, I'm one of the instructors for one of those modules on legal business design. So we worked with the organizers of iFlip, Bill Henderson, Kevin Colangelo, last year, maybe longer, I don't know, my timeline is all skewed, to basically help them launch the online certification program. And so anyone can sign up for that. I forget, quite honestly, if there's a cost or not. You go through the 5 modules and you get a certification from iFlip. From my understanding, real quickly, there are plans to relaunch the boot camps and internship opportunities next year. But I'm not exactly sure what all the details are there.
So what type of feedback did students, you know, and organizations kind of bring back? And, you know, because I'm just sort of curious, it's like, well, you know, did they offer feedback? Was that acted upon? You know, maybe is that part of the reason why it's coming, why the boot camp is coming back?
So I will say as a participating school, we didn't see a ton of the feedback. You know, our job was primarily to recommend students to enter the internship pool. And from there, it was a private employment relationship between the students and the employers, along with that 3-week boot camp. So we did not see a lot of feedback about it. And for us, we only had, I don't know, 7 or 8 students total go through the program over the 2 years. And so we couldn't really track over time that we didn't have enough to do any big study. Maybe iFlip did as a whole. I think what it did is it broadened students' lens. You know, students are very much in the law school mentality of thinking about legal doctrine and thinking about the writing side and the skills side. They are not thinking about the profession generally, and they are not thinking about these other sets of skills that they need. And I think iFlip, through the boot camp and the internship, very much put that on students' agenda. And it was right for Richmond at the same time that we as a school were thinking about these additional skills. So it was a great way for us to kind of get a window into this process and then come back and try to build our own program.
Well, anything that Bill Henderson and Kevin Colangelo work on, I have great faith that it's a great program. So Josh, I wanted to talk to you because I was talking to a friend of mine there at Richmond, and he kind of told me some stories of your travels, literally, between the time you were hired a couple of years ago and now, and that you've been traveling back and forth from Cincinnati to Richmond. First of all, how do you do that? And second, I'm sure there's some stories to tell along the way here.
And how long have you been doing this? Because, I mean, were you doing this during COVID? You know, how did you handle it?
Well, we can thank COVID for that commute because that wasn't the original intention. The original intention was to move to Richmond. And given the great pause on everyone's life that COVID introduced, certainly everyone was infected, and I'm certainly families were impacted much more negatively than mine. Mine just happens to be, we are not there in Richmond right now. And so I have been doing the commute, which is 7.5 hours one way every week. Oh. It's, I will say it has pressed my cognitive ability to turn 15 hours of driving into productive time. And everyone's like, have you thought of podcasts? Have you thought about, of course I have.
I was going to suggest this really good podcast you could listen to.
Yes, I'm familiar with your entire back catalog. You know, it's like I can go deep on any audio material. So it's a struggle. But I will say, all kidding aside, my first adjunct teaching was at Michigan State with Dan Katz and Renee Kanacki. And I drove 4.5 hours to teach a class, and then I drove back. So apparently there's something about me and teaching law students I'm willing to drive ungodly amounts of time. I don't know. It's worth it.
What kind of car do you have that you're putting all these miles on?
Funny you ask. I bought a Ford F-150 to make yes! that drive.
Nice and fuel efficient.
I wanted the size, you know. You want to feel like you're like, you know, part of all the truck traffic out there. So
you it's
know.
Almost yeah. like you're driving in your house in an F-150.
It's funny because when I moved down here to Houston in 2002, I would travel every week back to Oklahoma because we hadn't moved down here yet. And I had a Ford F-150, and it was a 7.5 hour drive. So I think I feel your pain
yes.
on that. Any tickets on the way to and from?
So real quickly, yes, I got one. Like one of my first drives.
You don't need to answer this. You don't need to answer
That's okay. I pled guilty. I paid the fine. I was fine. So now it's, you know, 9 is fine and 10 you're mine, right? So you've got to go 9 miles right. over on cruise. Let's see. I've hit a deer, so I've gotten that. Oof. So I hit a deer while moving into my apartment. So my bed was full, literally with my bed and other things, because I've rented an apartment there. In the rain, hit a deer. And let's keep the stories at that. I don't need anything. I like long, boring drives.
There we go.
All right. So we'll get back to Richmond Law and Business Forum. So, Jessica, you run the Richmond Law and Business Forum. Can you explain the mission you have with this forum and how it interacts with students' overall education?
Sure. So this is actually a little bit separate than what we've been talking about so far. So we've been talking about Josh's program on the legal business design side and Janice Kraft's program on the professional identity formation side. My program, the Richmond Law and Business Forum, is separate from those, but I think it's related in the sense that it recognizes that there is this broader set of skills that law students need. And for me, I see our program as a little bit on the career development side. I noticed that we kept telling students, you need to get out there, you need to network. And I have to imagine that if you're a law student, there's almost nothing more annoying than hearing professors and others say that.
Because you gotta get out there, kids. Like, come on. You gotta hustle. You gotta be hungry.
Meanwhile, yes, it's like that. So, and they think to themselves, am I just supposed to, how many cold emails can I send to people saying, you don't know me, but I'd like to take you to coffee, right? So what I wanted to do was to basically curate networking opportunities for our law students, create opportunities for them to meet and talk to business lawyers. And I wanted them to do that for two reasons. Number one, I wanted them to start to build their own professional networks and get used to thinking about their networks and how they're going to cultivate that network over time. And second, I really wanted them to get a sense as to what business law practice was like. Not just the law as we're reading it in the case books, but what do business lawyers actually do on a day-to-day basis? Is that something that aligns with their own professional goals and their own personal goals? And to think about when somebody says, do you want to be a business lawyer, to understand what types of roles are under that umbrella, how an IP lawyer is different from a securities lawyer, is different from a real estate lawyer. So we created this forum. When Dean Perdue and I were first talking about it, I said, I want to have a series of dinners where we can sit down, not these huge events in big classrooms where it's a lot of students sitting passively in an audience. I want people around a table talking to each other. And then COVID hit and we launched this program in the middle of COVID, where the idea of sitting around a table all of a sudden felt really dangerous. So we launched the program in January of last year. all of our events in the spring were on Zoom. And every single time, you know how it is when you log into a Zoom event that you're throwing and you think, am I throwing a Zoom party and will anybody show up? And every time I would log on and there'd be 50 students there, 60 students there. If we capped attendance, it would fill in 90 minutes. And it made me realize, like, students were hungry for this. This fall, we are back fully in person. So we're having in-person events. And we're having everything from what we're calling our Business Law Over Dinner series, which is we have three lawyers, five students, and me. And we sit around a table. We pick a particular area of law. So last week, it was intellectual property. Tomorrow night, we have one on mergers and acquisitions. 2 weeks from now, commercial real estate. And we just talk about the practice of law in that area with students who are interested in it or potentially interested. And then we have other events as well. So we have one, for example, on how to read a balance sheet. We have one on representing small businesses, on the startup community in Richmond. Just things where, you know, sort of the broader perspective that they may not get in some of their classes.
So how many students are showing up for the events now?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we are right now one of the largest student organizations at the law school, even though we launched 10 months ago. So we have 115 members. At our first event, I had us, the first event, which was on venture capital and private equity funding, I had us in a classroom that held 50 people. And while I was waiting for our speakers, one of my student organizers came out and said, Professor Erickson, we just filled the room. And luckily, I had booked a bigger room. And so we made everybody shift down. We probably had 70 people at that one. So what I'm learning is there's a lot of student appetite for this. And candidly, I think there's a lot of appetite for them to meet each other. We were in person last year, but the building was weird, right? The building didn't have the same energy. I'm finding a lot of our 1Ls are just as in our 2Ls are just as excited to meet each other as they are to meet the lawyer. So I think that's contributing as well.
Josh, for the Legal Business Design Hub, what's the process for the selection of an innovator in residence? Because I think you've had a couple now, right?
Yeah, we had Baker Donaldson last year, our first one, and we have Troutman Pepper coming up in 2022. And so the main role of the innovator in residence has to do with our legal business design challenge, which is a actual business challenge that's embedded in a full semester course. And so that's where the students are working literally side by side as part of a team, as part of a cohort with practitioners and business of law leaders and managers of an organization. In this case, it was Baker Donaldson and now going to be Troutman Pepper. They have to actually surface a real business opportunity. This is not purely vanity. This is not just something we make up. We literally spend time with law firm leadership to unearth some opportunities in the marketplace that the firm might want to pursue. And then we spend the majority of the class, students and practitioners and business leaders of the law firm, working to really stress test that, validate that, and then ultimately sort of present that to law firm leadership so they have a clearer sense of what is the possible business impact, what's the possible client impact, and what would we actually need to do to go pursue this. So to answer your question, how do we sort of select the innovator in residence? We have to find an organization that's willing to invest time, actual human beings, right, that understand that they're going to be opening up to some degree, the curtain on their business model, on their culture, on their strategy. Now, we don't ask for client-sensitive information and data, anything like that, but they have to be willing to have frank, candid conversations with the students, because at the end of the day, to stress test an actual business opportunity, you have to know what the firm is capable of doing and not capable of doing. And so that's sort of the best way to think about what goes into an innovator in residence. Now, the model will change based on the organization we're working with. Baker Donaldson, Troutman Pepper, both larger law firms. Yes, they tend to have more resources, by the way, which is why they might be good fits here. But that doesn't preclude us working with a legal aid association or something like that downstream. It's just really an intentional commitment on part of the organization to advance an opportunity that they're sensing in the marketplace.
You mentioned that each year is different. I know you did Baker Donaldson the first year and Troutman. Is it Sanders or Troutman Pepper? I can't remember with all the mergers
Troutman Pepper now, yes.
Okay, all right. What was the difference between the two programs? What did you do the first year and how'd that differ the second year?
So there's a number of ways to sort of cut at that. One, though, the caveat is we have yet to launch the Troutman Pepper one. So they come in January. Now I'm working with law firm leadership now to sort of set the stage and all that and prepare for the actual course. But they become the innovator in residence, creating the relationship with the law school in January of 2022. So we really haven't gotten that one off the ground or fully designed it. But to answer your question, some of the changes that I've made already is, so let's just back up. I just became a full-time faculty member. Before that, I was an adjunct. And life is different as a full-time faculty member versus adjunct. Not better, not worse, just different. So I became full-time.
That's very politically put. Well done. Well done.
Thanks. And I did this at the height of COVID. So first-time full-time faculty member, first world pandemic to be sort of involved in and living through. And I decided then my very first class, I'm going to launch the Legal Business Design Challenge. The students did not know who Professor Josh Kubicki was at this point. No one knew what an innovator in residence was. And yeah, somehow I thought this was amazing, great idea that I could pull off. Thankfully I did, but I probably created so much more work for myself. It was insane, but it was successful. So the things that I'm going to change, lessons learned, is one, it was a lot for my law students, right? This is the thing about teaching that you truly can't appreciate until you're standing in front of a group of law students and you take responsibility for their future livelihood and their development. You own that as part of their teacher and professor. And I realized the way I presented the material, I was taking way too much for granted, especially at the time of COVID when everyone was max stressed and all that. So I've redesigned the curriculum to usher the students into it in a more organic way instead of, and I'll be honest, I was probably force feeding a little bit too much and expecting them to connect the dots. They are students after all. Yes, some are second careerists, some are straight out of undergrad, but they're in that academic setting. And part of the Legal Business Design Challenge is to ground them in business reality, ground them in the practical life of being in a business that delivers legal services. But I can't like just go to the edge and push them over. So this I've designed.
You're a much nicer professor than the ones I had.
Indeed.
I can't have it takes a different mindset for the law student. Like they're coming to me and they're usually coming from the more traditional law school classes, which are very valuable, but it requires a different way of behaving and thinking when you step into the business context, especially when you start putting the lens on legal service businesses. So I had to understand that. So I've redesigned sort of their experience. I've also made it 4 credits instead of 3 credits to represent sort of the heightened nature of the work and all that. And obviously I've changed sort of the innovator in residence role, making their role more organic and immersive right alongside with the students.
About how many students do you have in the program each year?
Well, in the Legal Business Design Challenge, the first semester we had 11. My goal is to get at least 12. I think I would have to be careful about going above that because the work for me is high and I love doing it. But there's enormous burden on me to make sure the students are maximizing their learning, not just keeping busy. And I've got to manage a law firm. Lawyers and business leaders on the law firm side recognizing their time constraints and all that. So there's a lot of sort of management on the back end that I've got to take care of.
It seems a labor intensive on both sides. And, you know, in order to get the best possible outcome, you really do kind of have to limit it.
Yes.
Yeah. I was thinking, as you were saying, they were coming out of a more traditional classroom into your program. I imagine a different part of the brain lights up under a CAT scan if you had them scanned on both classes. So yeah, it may take a few minutes for them to adjust. So Marlene and I did this online conference recently and with HBR, and their CEO, Nick Quill, said something there that really stuck with me. And that was, when it comes to innovation, and he was talking about law firms, he was saying the attorney is the innovation. And meaning that no matter how much you may have an innovation plan in a professional services industry like the law. If the lawyer doesn't actually implement or apply the innovation, it might as well not even exist. So how is it that you train the law students there to understand that innovation isn't innovation until you actually put it into action?
Or to even be open to it.
Yeah.
do you want me to go first negative on that, Jessica? Or okay. So
yeah,
it's a fair observation. I would disagree with it to some, although I know Nick personally and I'm friends and respect him, but I won't unpack where I disagree with some of what he said. But to the point that you've just made, first and foremost, yes, it's everything's at the human level, which is why design is part of the program for us, okay? And this is not design thinking, okay? That's a subset of design. So design is really a human interaction with something, a service, a product, a technology, another human. How do we actually create that interaction in a meaningful and authentic way, right? So when we think about sort of innovation in law, and Nick's right, a lawyer at some point in time, because lawyers are the only vehicles outside of Arizona and Utah right now, in the States that can deliver legal services. So ultimately, a lawyer must be involved in integrating, using, or otherwise adopting an innovation. So if that's the case, then we simply have to embed in our students' minds, first of all, that's okay. Like, that's okay. Changing how things have been done, not for the sake of change, but for the sake of improving a client outcome, a client experience, your personal experience, lawyer, in your daily life, or the experience you're creating for your employees or peers. Like, if we're improving that, that's okay. Like, that should be part of our daily work, just going around and being good lawyers. So it's about really embedding that mindset. And the second thing is, actually give them the skills and toolkit so that they can do some of this themselves. We all know from change management, if something happens to you, that's quite a different feeling than you helping to create the change itself. If you're part of the conversation and you feel smart and equipped to do that, not put in the deep end, not being told, just go innovate and come back to me with something, like, that's unfair. So how do we sort of create this awareness and skill set where lawyers actually feel fully capable of doing this? And we don't have sort of any of the, what is that curve? The Dunning-Kruger curve, where we all think we're experts immediately, and then we fall into the pit of despair or whatever. So, which happens a lot, by the way, when we talk about innovation in law.
Now, to be fair to Nick, that was just one part of a larger saying, but that was one part that stuck with me.
Well, so, I wanted to create a little controversy.
So you may not have as much to argue with him about.
So the only other thing that I would add there is that to me, it really does highlight why I think our two programs that we launched at the same time are so important to be together and why they are synergistic in that way. I mean, what we're really talking about is listening to people and connecting with people and making sure that you have cultural competence and empathy and all the other human skills to make innovation work, make it actually happen, right? We can sit in our own offices and come up with the best possible business design, but if you can't actually get people to adopt it, if it doesn't resonate with them, it's not gonna work. And so part of this is really figuring out, where are the lawyers? Where are the clients? What do they need? What do they want? And being able to connect with that human side of the law.
All right, so I'm going to go back to my measuring questions again, except this time I'm sort of applying it to your programs there at Richmond. So, you know, how are you measuring your progress and success, you know, with the programs, and what is the feedback you're getting, and like, how are participants applying what they've learned?
So I'll answer this one from sort of the administration side of things, and I don't actually administer these programs, but at least for me, one thing I would really emphasize is just how new these programs are. These programs both launched in the fall of 2020, right? In the state of the world where that is. So to me, at least, I'm not at the stage of saying, can we exactly measure the outcomes? I think we're still in the stage of figuring out exactly what it is that we're trying to achieve. Because remember that the people you had designing this were largely doctrinal law professors. We said in our report what we thought it should be. But we weren't the experts, and we recognized that right from the get-go. We have brought in two experts who are themselves figuring out law schools and law students. So I don't want us to start measuring things until we know what it is we're trying to achieve. And I think we're still, I want us to be deliberative and contemplative about that. And I also think, I don't think this is something where you're going to have really hard metrics in terms of, we want to see 5% of our students getting particular jobs in this area. That, for me at least, is not the goal. I think the goal is that they would go into a wide array of jobs and bring this skill set and deploy it in predictable ways and perhaps unpredictable ways as their careers in the industry evolve. So I'm not sure exactly what the precise measures would look like. But Josh, I don't know.
Before we get to Josh, I wanted to ask something, because a couple episodes ago we had a couple of people that wrote this legal design book. And one of the things that they said, and again, they were talking more about law firms, but I think maybe law schools fit this as well. Are you measuring enough now to determine once you have the change? So in other words, do you have a base that you're kind of measuring that you can look back on? So as you go through the chain, if you go through these programs, you've got at least, this is where we started. We may not know where we're going to end up, but at least we know we've measured something at the beginning. Do law schools do that?
No. Just candidly, no, we really don't. What we measure are the inputs. We don't measure the outputs. In other words, we tend to measure what learning students are being exposed to, right? So we'll be able to tell you how many courses they were taking in this area versus how many they take, hopefully, when we build out both programs to their full capacity. That's just measuring kind of what went in. What then comes out? No, I don't think we do a very good job of measuring it.
Other than bar passage and higher rates.
Exactly. And I'm not sure that this will directly feed in there. Maybe it will in some unexpected ways, but clearly our goals.
Maybe it will shock the system enough to say, okay, well, look, let's look back and, you know, here is our base model. And then we can go forward.
Here's the base. And like, it would be interesting, like in 5 years to kind of have an alumni, you know, just sort of have an alumni model. It's like, what are people doing? And, you know, how have they applied it in different, different roles? Okay. Sorry, Josh, we got to let you talk now.
No, that's fine. I think you guys have just summed up the part of my journey in joining the law school faculty, right? So you just heard Jessica talk about measurement and all that, or lack thereof, or measurement on the front end. And I come from the business side where I'm always measuring out the output, the outcome. There's no reason to do upstream activity unless we're measuring something downstream. And so yes, while the programs are new, you know, I'm already thinking about how do we actually measure this. And so a couple of points I just want to bring out. One of the things we haven't talked about, which again differentiates our law school, Richmond, from others, is that in our career development office, we have a role specifically for emerging careers in the law. Notice I said emerging. We don't say alternative. We don't say anything like that. We say emerging, right? And it's really meant to help facilitate the dialogue, the awareness amongst students, amongst alumni in the market, that there are new roles emerging for JD graduates, right? And that's part of our program here. We're all sort of focused on that. So yes, an easy measurement might be, let's define categorically what a traditional employment situation looks like for a Richmond grad a year out or 2 years out, and let's start measuring and see how many. Now that's not causality, like, because if the world is expanding in emerging roles, we may not be creating that demand, but we're creating sort of supply of talent, which we should, by the way. We should be doing that. But Marlene, to your point, one of the things that I think is an advantage of the Legal Business Design Challenge, part of our program, is it does create a very unique student experience. And to your point of alumni, like, there is a plan to create a Legal Business Design Challenge alumni or participant network where we, like Baker Donaldson, like they're not done. Like, they now have a relationship with this school. They are now going to start recruiting. They weren't recruiting our grads before, and they're going to start recruiting the emerging role too. So now we've got a law firm that is now more invested in students. And I hope Trautman Pepper does that too. So we bring back Baker Donaldson, we bring back Trautman Pepper and the students in a year or so. And yes, we have the discussion, how do we measure this? We do grab the anecdotes and the stories and all that, and we start to pull that stuff together. It will take time, but I do believe there's a strong narrative here. I don't think there's going to be a lack of measurement. I think there's just enough data. When do we have enough information and data to create a meaningful measurement?
So, Josh, other than a move to Richmond and resting your Ford F-150 a little bit, what kind of plans do the two of you and I guess also Janice Kraft as well in her program, what's on the horizon for the next year or two?
So for me, one of the things Josh and I have talked a lot about is building in layers. I think it's really, really tempting when you start a new program to do all of the things, right? To just start building in every direction all at once. And I think that's a bad idea from a number of levels, but especially right now during COVID with all of its limitations. For me, I would love to see us, let's figure out, you know, what is our first layer? Let's really get set. What is the course piece of this? And what courses do we want? Then we can start building out in terms of more co-curriculars and more, you know, classes being taught by adjuncts who are coming in. Because look, I think I would love to see us have lots of courses in this area. Josh is only one person. Janice is only one person, right? So how do we build out in other directions? For me, I would love to see these two programs be real keystones to the school, to be something that, you know, every Richmond Law graduate has these two sets of skills along with all the other traditional skills. It's going to take some time to build out that program in a really full way, but I can't wait to see it happen.
That sounds great.
And Josh, how about you?
I'll just second what Jessica just said. I mean, it's challenging to check yourself. And I'll say course design again, going back to new faculty, designing a course, I mean, there's no textbooks for the stuff I teach. There just aren't. Yes, there's lots of people who have written books. And yes, we have, of course, Richard Susskind and all that kind of, but I don't use those books. What I'm teaching is a lot more practical, to be completely blunt, and completely attached to understanding how business operates today and tomorrow. So I've got to create all of the content, all the curriculum. And quite honestly, one thing we didn't touch on is, what is the learner's experience? What is the student's experience in my classes? And so, you know, COVID taught some people a lot of things. I happened to work this way beforehand, being an entrepreneur, working remotely, embracing digital technology. I've been embedding that into my classroom, right? So the students have living, breathing digital workbooks that I pre-populate, and then they have to work to expand over the course of the semester. You know, I complement my classroom experience with short bursts, videos, and short excerpts of content and all that kind of stuff. So we're not just talking about the content and the substance. We're talking about the student experience as well. And how do we sort of put all that together? So to answer your question, continue the testing, continue sort of making sure we're adding value to the students' lives day one, and really focus on finding the right pieces of curriculum to be sort of building this program around. And it sounds like it should be easy. I'll just tell you, it's not. It's not easy to do this. It's challenging, for me anyway.
I bet it is not. Well, Josh Kubicki and Jessica Erickson from Richmond Law School, we really appreciate you coming in and talking about your programs there.
Yeah, thank you so
much. Thanks for having us.
So that was a great conversation. And I mean, I was making notes about like all the things I liked about it. So, yeah. You know, I love this whole, and this is that separate program about sort of comparing your values to the values of the profession. I think that is so important because, you know, I don't know about you, but I didn't have any knowledge of law firms. I mean, we didn't have any lawyers in the family. And so I kind of came in very, you know, open, like, okay, like LA law, that's what I knew about law. And so I think it's super important for, you know, students coming in to really get a sense of, okay, this is what the business of law is all about, you know, and compare that to what your values are, you know, to make sure that you're comfortable with that. The other thing I liked, and it was in relation to that, is doing things that are manageable, basically teaching students to, you know, engage in your profession, but in a way that's manageable. And, you know, all I kept thinking is like, yep, it's a marathon. It's not a race. And, you know, this is something you want to do long term. And if you don't take those things into account, you know, you burn yourself out. Oh, I liked the creating of network opportunities. You know, as someone, I mean, I think to myself in law school, I mean, I was very quiet, very shy. I know you're shocked, but it's true. And having something like that, I think would have helped, you know, me kind of interact. And I think, you know, anybody that's in that position, you know, it's like, you don't know people and sort of having that opportunity presented to you, I think is wonderful. And the last thing I had was measuring output. I think this has come up in other podcasts we've talked about with law schools. Once the students leave, the job is not done, I don't think. And I think it's really important, as Josh mentions, like you should be measuring outputs because that just ties back to your program and makes your program better. It's sort of like when you finish a project, you kind of have that exit meeting. It's like, okay, what happened? What are the results? What should we change? What should we adjust? And that type of thing, I think, is critical for a successful program.
Yeah. And just a couple of things that caught my attention during this is one, just the practical business application skills, like Jessica teaching the students how to read a balance sheet. Because like we talked about previously, that even after 4 or 5 years of practicing law, some of these attorneys will never have any business experience. And so, you know, being able to teach some of the things there. And the other thing, which was funny, because it kind of tied back to our CLE episode, was when Josh was talking about putting in short videos into the training of the students. Again, that adult learning through short, precise, small tasks like that and teaching through videos. Perfect. Perfect. So thanks again to Josh Kubicki and to Jessica Erickson from Richmond Law for sharing all of this with us. It was that was fantastic.
Yeah, great show. So Pod Dog's going to help me do the credits. Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen to the Geek and Review podcast.
Whether you're a longtime fan like our friend Marshall or if this is your first time listening, we'd love to hear what you think. So embrace your social media presence and send us a note.
If you enjoyed the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached on Twitter at Glambert.
Or you can leave us a voicemail on the Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7270. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I will talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye. Yeah.